Good afternoon. Chag Sameach. Happy festival. We're glad that you're listening, and some of you will be hearing this after the fact, perhaps though on this same day, or maybe later on during this festival, during these 7 days of the Festival of Tabernacles, or perhaps on the last day, the eighth day of Sacred Assembly, a separate festival that is, of course, immediately adjoining this one. So thanks a lot for listening. We're going to be actually webcasting a complete service. And so the opening prayer for thousands of years in the temple, the Levites have recited on Tuesday the 82nd Psalm. Christ quoted from it in the 10th chapter of John. So for the opening prayer, we're going to have Psalm 82, and that'll be by Dubie Mosley.
A Psalm of Asaph. God presides over heaven's court. He pronounces judgment on the heavenly beings. How long will you hand down unjust decisions by favoring the wicked? Interlude. Give justice to the poor and the orphan. Uphold the rights of the oppressed and the destitute. Rescue the poor and helpless. Deliver them from the grasp of evil people. But these oppressors know nothing. They are so ignorant. They wander about in darkness while the whole world is shaken to the core. I say, you are gods, you are all children of the Most High, but you will die like mere mortals and fall like every other ruler. Rise up, O God, and judge the earth, for all the nations belong to you.
That is a very powerful psalm. One could certainly go on at great length about that. Anyway, thanks again for being with us and listening as we go along here. You know, we have our aches and pains in this world, in this life. We're physical. We're mere mortals. So we have various things we have to deal with, such as dental visits. Recently, my daughter Rachel went to the dentist, and he said to her, "Don't worry," he said. "I am painless." She said to him, "I am not." No, that story isn't really true, but thought you might get a kick out of that. We have some beautiful hymns, if you don't mind my saying that in advance, that we want to do together. You will recognize the first one, perhaps, written by John O'Donnell back in the 1980s when he was a student at Ambassador College. It's called "The World Today." That'll be our opening hymn, performed by Daniel on the keyboard by Daniel Kaplan, and we'll be singing it here in Kissimmee, Florida. And if you know the song, you could, of course, be singing along wherever you're listening.
Something to notice is that the second page has the second and third verse. Once she finishes the first page, once you never have to go back to it.
Thank you.
Thank you to Daniel. Actually, we had a plan for Daniel also to do a musical presentation. So, again, if you want to be meditating on some of the meaning of the day or listening in, however you choose to participate in this, but I'll let Daniel introduce this piece he's going to do. It'll be one that he'll be performing and that he composed himself. And we'll also be getting to hear a hymn that he composed at the end of the service. So now to do a musical presentation, Daniel Kaplan.
The name of the song is Reach the Top.
Thank you, Daniel, and as I told the people last night, hang around and you'll get to hear him perform again. He'll be doing a hymn that he composed. He did one last night that we really enjoyed, and we're looking forward to the next one. Well, we're grateful again to have people sharing this festival with us. I want to acknowledge that we did receive a very fine message from Feast Keepers in I believe it was Chiang Mai, which is quite an impressive place to visit in Thailand, one of those must-see places, I guess, if you get over there. So we did have a communication from Thailand. We want to thank them for contacting us and acknowledge that. I didn't know that Leon Sexton at this point in time was having health difficulties. I don't know what they are, but please, let's keep Leon Sexton in our prayers. He's an old friend, and he does have a ministry in what we used to call Indochina, and evidently it is bearing fruit. He does have a number of people keeping the festival there in Thailand. Well, wherever you're listening from, again, Chag Sameach, happy festival to you. I have probably used this title before, but it can be used from year to year. The title is More on the Meaning of the Festival of Tabernacles. I could always use it. You know, we can never, I suppose, exhaust it. More on the Meaning of the Festival of Tabernacles. This is a Christian festival. Now, I understand that out in the world, what awareness there is of it is as a Jewish holiday. You know, it's interesting that the Israelis escaped some of the problems on their stock market because of the fact that the stock market came during the season when a lot of them are not operating, doing business. We had the Festival of Trumpets, which the Israelis tend to keep for 2 days, and then the Day of Atonement, and then today was the Festival of Tabernacles. So in some ways the volatility was less in Israel because there just wasn't an opportunity. The market was closed for a lot of it. So people did have some awareness of the fact that today is a so-called Jewish holiday over in Israel, because in the stock market report they mentioned, well, this Tel Aviv exchange will be closed for the Jewish festival. But this is a festival, yes, that Jews celebrate, as they should, but it is a Christian festival. And there are some Christians celebrating it who are not of Jewish descent, as many of you. Some of you are, most of you probably are not. If you look at John 7, you see that Christ set the example of keeping this day. And not only that, but a very big chunk of the New Testament is involving this season of the year. You might argue that all the way from John 7 to John 10:21 could have taken place during these 8 days we're observing. And much of the imagery in John's writings, both here and in the book of Revelation, is connected to this festival. Now, if you look at John 7, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. So his life is now in danger if he goes to Judea. He's up in Galilee, up north. If he goes south, he's in danger. Now, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. There's a Jewish Festival of Tabernacles, and then there's the Christian version. They're not exactly the same. In ancient times, Jews felt obligated, if possible, to go to Jerusalem to keep the festival. And they had specific traditions connected to the festival that were Jewish traditions. So you notice that with the Feast of Dedication, it doesn't say the Jews' Feast of Dedication, you know, because why should it? The Feast of Dedication, by definition, is a Jewish festival. It's not commanded on the entire church. But the Festival of Tabernacles is for the entire church, but there is a Jewish version of it. So I believe that's why it talks here about the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. So that would mean going to Jerusalem. That would mean jeopardizing his life. His brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." So you see, at this point, his own family was skeptical of who he was. Amazing that that would be the case. But later on, of course, two of his brothers became writers of New Testament books. "For even his brothers did not believe in him." That was the situation then. Amazing. "Then Jesus said to them, 'My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time is not yet fully come.'" In other words, I'm not going up with you because I don't want to jeopardize my life at this point. At some point I'll be martyred. It's not the time. So I'm going to be careful how I go, when I go and how I do it. "When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, but not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, 'Where is he?'" Once he got there, he was safe because he was popular with a lot of people. Yes, there were those who didn't like him, but there were others who either liked him or didn't like him but respected him. So once he got there, he was safe, but he had to go incognito. Verse 12. "And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, 'He is good.' Others said, 'No, on the contrary, he deceives the people.' However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews." So the establishment of that time had already made their decision. They didn't like him. "Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. Oh, so he taught at the middle of the feast, not just on the high days. So he was there for the whole time, and he was teaching in the middle of the feast. And so we do that. We have services during these days. And so God willing, if I'm able, I plan to be teaching during the middle of the feast as well. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? You know, he was not what we call nowadays, a yeshiva bucher. He wasn't one who'd been given the kind of training that the Apostle Paul was given formally, but he really knew his stuff. Of course, even at the age of 12, he dazzled the rabbis back then at the Passover. So Christ kept this festival, taught in the middle of the festival, even risked his life to attend the festival, as you see. And set that example, because it is a commanded festival. In Deuteronomy 16, it's a commanded festival. And I read that last night. I'm not going to go back over it again. But I will go to Leviticus 23. And in Leviticus 23, we're commanded to keep this festival. And I won't even read all of those verses, but I will go to the end of Leviticus 23. Because there it focuses on what you do differently. What is the unique characteristic of this festival? Every festival has its characteristics. For example, it's a festival, so you don't go to work. You have a holiday. It's a festival. but each festival has its own unique characteristic. And regarding the Festival of Tabernacles, we see in verse 40 of Leviticus 23, and you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Eternal your God for 7 days. So these items are going to be used as decorative items and also as construction items, to put together some kind of a temporary dwelling for yourself, because this is to be a time of temporary dwellings. Now, very, very likely in the wilderness, when the Israelites were there, they would have been living in a tent structure. They wouldn't have had a lot of vegetation to use to make a dwelling. So it would have been more of a tent there in the wilderness. Here it's a structure made of materials available to them in those days and in that climate. You shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal for 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. Now, here's where I want to focus on. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. We call it the Feast of Tabernacles. That sounds very, very, what's the right word? Formal or somewhat archaic. It could be called the Feast of Booths, but we want to make sure it's not the Feast of Booths. I guess maybe that's why we don't use that term. I mean, we can, of course, we should drink freely of alcohol in moderation. At the festival in moderation. But it is a feast of booths or temporary dwellings. It is Sukkot. Sukkah is translated various ways in the Bible, the term Sukkah. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know. Oh, there's a reason to do it. That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal your God. I wanted to cover today the meaning of this festival of temporary dwellings. I wanted to focus on that aspect of it, the fact that during this time of the year we dwell in temporary dwellings. I'm speaking to you from a temporary facility for me. It's as if I were on the road. I had to travel to get here. Now it's true it wasn't all that far because I'm keeping it in Central Florida, but I still had to travel from my normal place where I live to another place. I had to pack. I had to bring things with me. And I'm in a place now that I know I'm not going to stay in. I am now, in effect, a traveler. And so many of you are in the same situation. You're not where you'd normally be. You're in a temporary dwelling. So this is a festival of temporary dwellings, a festival of booths. And I want to go through the meaning of that. There's a lot involved in that. And I'm only going to be able to scratch the surface. What I hope I do today is get you where you can pursue some of these themes and thoughts and go into it when you have time to do so. I'd like to go to Nehemiah the 8th chapter. Nehemiah the 8th chapter. In And there you see that if you begin in the first verse of that chapter, they're having in effect a religious revival under Nehemiah and under Ezra. And that religious revival involves the keeping of the annual festivals. So they're gathering together for the Festival of Trumpets in Nehemiah 8. And as they keep reading, they see that there's another festival coming up they should be keeping. And by the way, it's interesting that they were all broken up because they'd been so negligent in their behavior that they had been ignoring the holy days. They felt very bad about it, and they got really broken up about it. And he told them, no, enjoy the holy day, rejoice. That was the point that I brought out last night. This is supposed to be a happy time. And so as the people were crying because they had been so wicked, Ezra and Nehemiah encouraged them. Look at Nehemiah 8:9. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and the scribe and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, this day is holy to the eternal your God. Do not mourn nor weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Then he said to them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow. For the day of the eternal is your strength. So the Levites quieted all the people, saying, be still, for the day is holy, do not be grieved. And all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions, and rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. And as I said, they made sure that everybody was able to celebrate, even the ones less fortunate. And then, if you keep read further, now on the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people, with the priests and the Levites, were gathered to Ezra, the scribe, in order to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law, which the Eternal had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month. And so they in effect said, hey, like many of you, I grew up in the Jewish community, so I was aware of this holiday, but I know many of you grew up in other kinds of communities, and were not necessarily as children aware of this day. And so you read the Bible and learned about it. And even these people who should have known better had neglected the day, and now they were realizing, hey, we've been neglecting this day. Verse 15, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the mountain and bring olive branches, which are not mentioned back in the Pentateuch, branches of oil trees, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booths. Oh, that's what the materials were for, to make booths, as it is written. Now, as I said, in the desert, they wouldn't have had those materials to make booths. Chances are they would have had animal skin there, and they would have had a tent. But here they were making booths from elements of nature. Then the people went out and brought them and made themselves booths, each one on the roof of his house or in their courtyards or the courts of the house of God, and in the open square of the water gate, and in the open square of the gate of Ephraim. So the whole assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and sat under the booths. For since the days of Joshua the son of Nun until the day of the children of Israel, until that day the children of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. So there had not been a time since Joshua when evidently the entire community, there was virtually 100% participation. Evidently, during other times, some had taken the trouble to do it, and some had not. I'm not sure of all the implications of that statement, but that may be one of the implications. That here we had virtually everybody involved in keeping this. So they studied it. They studied. They learned to do it, and they constructed these temporary dwellings. Now, one of the reasons for these temporary dwellings is very basic. God deals with human beings, in effect, on his initiative. He has decided he wants to share eternity with others. First, he created an angelic realm, and now he's creating people who can even have more potential in a certain way to be on his level and interact with him as his children. He is creating a family. He's creating children to share eternity with him, sons and daughters. So he has, in effect, called humanity in that sense. And he then called a nation. He called a nation and selected them to be his people and delivered them from bondage. And so when we keep this festival, we're remembering the calling of Israel. Israel was taken from Egypt, and they dwelt in booths because they were leaving Egypt and entering the Promised Land and making that trip to the Promised Land because God had brought them out miraculously from Egypt and was miraculously guiding them to a Promised Land. So we remember the Exodus and remember God's calling when we keep this festival. If you go to 1 John 4, it's a very basic truth in God's religion, both under the Old Testament and under the New Testament. Under the Old Testament, we have the Exodus, where God miraculously calls Israel out of Egypt. Then we have in the New Testament the ministry of Jesus Christ, where God becomes man, sacrifices himself for man, and then is resurrected and begins the church. So in each case, we have a direct involvement of God in initiating a relationship with human beings. The great event in the Old Testament was the Exodus. The great event in the New was the ministry of Jesus Christ. And so in 1 John 4:19, we love him because he first loved us. So Israel, you know, leaves Egypt, and we have this Israel dwelling in temporary dwellings as they go through Egypt. And if you'll see the wanderings of the children of Israel as they leave Egypt, they even come to a place called Sukkot. There was a place called temporary dwellings, one of the spots that they stayed in took that name because they were dwelling in Sukkot as they wandered through the wilderness. And another reason to remember that God caused the Israelites to dwell in booths during that time is because these booths symbolized his protection over them. What do booths do for you? They protect you from the sun. They protect you from the rain, from the wind. There are certain form of protection, even from certain beasts, certain animals. You know, at least if you have some kind of walls around you, they are a protection. And they represent God's providence over his people. So he took us out, he called us, and then he led us providentially. Let's go back to an even more basic point. And that is my second point. When he called Israel out of Egypt, they had to go from Egypt to the promised land, and there was a transition in between. And it was during that time that he organized them as his church. He gave them his law. He took them to Sinai, gave them his law, and then after that, he brought them into the promised land. Now, they should have gone fairly soon. It would have been a couple of years, and they would have been there, not 40. 40 was because they, you know, rebelled and so on. He wasn't intending it initially to be 40 years. It would have been about a two-year experience, not 40. But he did have that transition when they were, in effect, making a pilgrimage from point A to point B, from the world of slavery to the world of freedom. And this life is, in that sense, a pilgrimage. This is something to remember, that the life we live now is a pilgrimage. We are heading towards a greater reality. This life is a temporary trip, and when you take a trip, you know, obviously, you nowadays, when you take a trip, you stay in hotels, motels, or you camp out. You go to a campground, or maybe you have an RV. You know, you don't have the kind of dwelling that you normally live in permanently. So it symbolizes, being in a temporary dwelling symbolizes the fact that this life is a pilgrimage. It's a journey. So let's not get so focused on the journey that we forget that we do have a destination. You know, if you get so wrapped up in your temporary facility, you'll forget where you're going. And the important thing is to get to where you're going. So let's go to Hebrews 11. In Hebrews 11 and verse 13, talking about those who've gone before, the saints who've gone before, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Let's go to verse 16. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. We're heading towards that new Jerusalem. We are marching in a certain direction as we live our lives. So keep that goal in mind. You know, keep the kingdom of God in mind. We are, in that sense, strangers and pilgrims. And the bodies that we have now are temporary dwellings. We will eventually have spirit bodies. Which, of course, is a difficult term to understand, but we will have bodies that will not be physical. They will be spirit. 1 Corinthians 15 talks about that. We're going to go from physical to spirit. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 5, and you'll see how Paul compared his body to a tabernacle. In 2 Corinthians 5. So what I'm talking about now is the fact that we are, in effect, pilgrims. In 2 Corinthians 5, Paul says, But we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. We want that spirit body. That's what we're hoping for. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. We don't want to die. No, we want to live, but we want to live as spirit. We want to live in that condition. We don't want the aches, the pains, you know, and all that goes with physical life. We appreciate the good side of it, but we know there's a lot better one ahead of us, spirit life. Now, he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who also has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. You know, so God has given us his Spirit as a down payment on that new building, that new that Spirit building. Let's go now to 2 Peter. Peter knew that he was going to be martyred and that his life would be cut short. So he writes this in 2 Peter verse 13, 2 Peter 1, 13. Yes, I think it is right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent, just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me. Moreover, I will be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease, or my exodus, my departure. I'm leaving this world. I'm going to be dying. But nevertheless, you know, I know that my body is a tent, and the tent, you know, eventually is taken down, and, you know, we put pitch, you know, take down the tents, pitching a tent, I guess, is the opposite. Then we take down the tent and we move on. And so Peter knew he was moving on, and he knew that he would be resurrected and have a spirit body. So we are in a pilgrimage, and as I said already, on this pilgrimage, we have God's providence guiding us and directing us along the way. And in ancient times, as God led them through the wilderness, he sustained them miraculously with manna. And he protected them from the problems you're going to have in a wilderness environment, you know, in a desert environment such as they had. He quenched their thirst. He guided them, he protected them with a cloud by day and guided them. He guided them with fire by night. I'd like to go to Numbers 13. I'm sorry, Exodus 13. In Exodus 13, if you go towards the end of that chapter, verse 20, here we have the word Sukkot, as I referred to earlier. So they took their journey from Sukkot. And we know it's a logical place to call a place where a lot of people are camping. And camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Eternal went before them, I'm in Exodus 13:21, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way. And so the tabernacle we live in is symbolic of that cloud that protected them, the temporary dwelling we have. And it also was a guide to them, of course. And by night, in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and night. So they actually had a sign of his presence there, a pillar of fire by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Now, when this day was celebrated 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem, it was celebrated with temporary dwellings, but also with torchlight parades, reminding them of the fire that had led them by night. So one of the things that they did in ancient times was torchlight parades. And they also had water pouring ceremonies, reminding them of how God had sustained them miraculously with water out of the rock, sustaining them. And of course, it also was a prayer for rain during the rainy season, because this festival precedes the season of heavy rain in Israel. I'd like to go to Psalm 78, and I certainly pray that those coming, you know, once you get back from the feast in California, I do hope you have plenty of rain out there, because I know you really need it out there. I don't think you'd mind even getting it right now. You probably wouldn't even mind getting rain down during the feast to get those fires under control. I'd like to go to Psalm 78, if I may. Psalm 78, and I'm still on the third point of the divine providence that this day pictures, or this festival pictures. Verse 14 of Psalm 78. In the daytime also he led them with the cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink in abundance for the like the depths. He also brought streams out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. So the imagery of this festival is fire and water. You know, you can read that if you read John 7 and the book of Revelation. God, a cloud is condensed water, for that matter, water vapor. He led them with a cloud by day, with fire by night, and he providentially took care of them, which is one of the meanings of this Festival of Tabernacles, God's protection, God's providence. I'd like to go to Psalm 27. Psalm 27 and verse 4. I'm sorry, verse 5. Psalm 27, 5. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion. Or, you know, that the word there is sukkah. In the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock. So this tabernacle this temporary dwelling we live in is symbolic of God's protection. Obviously, right now, if I were outside, I'd be in the sun, and I'm wearing a suit, and I'd be rather hot out there. And then I'd be subject to, if it starts pouring rain, I'd have that. If it's in a colder climate, I'd have that to issue, worry about, and so on and so forth. So I'm glad I'm in a building. It's comfortable in here, even in ancient Israel, a temporary dwelling was more comfortable than just being outside. So as it says, God protects us, and so that's in Psalm 27:5. I'd like to now go to Isaiah, the fourth chapter. And if you go to the end of that chapter, you see that in the millennium, God's protection is symbolized by this same imagery. Isaiah 4 and verse 5. Isaiah 4:5. Then the Eternal will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering or canopy, and there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime, sukkah. There will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime from the heat, for a place of refuge and for shelter from storm and rain. So you see, as I said, the temporary dwelling of this time of year symbolizes the fact that we are not without help in this life. We're pilgrims, yes, but we have that temporary dwelling that we use on the pilgrimage, which symbolizes God's protection. I'd like to go to the book of Jonah. The Jews read the book of Jonah on the Day of Atonement, and it kind of connects with the Festival of Tabernacles towards the end of the book. In ultra-Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods, if you're wandering through right after the Day of Atonement, that night you'll be hearing clop, clop, clop as people begin to hammer the first nails into their temporary dwelling, the sukkah. And if you go to Jonah, towards the end of the book of Jonah, now we understand the book of Jonah better than we used to, in my opinion, because we've been hearing reports from Iraq, and our prayers go out to those in Iraq, soldiers serving there. Our prayers go out to them, are with them, and they are in a hot climate. Iraq has temperatures that I have never seen even in Arizona, and so you can imagine how hot Jonah was there being in Iraq. That's where he went, and here in, by the way, don't misunderstand my comment. I pray for those troops, but I realize it's not my place to participate in warfare. That is not something that we do as Christians. But I certainly pray for the success of those over there. In Jonah, the fourth chapter, in verse 5, so Jonah went out of the city and sat on the east side of the city. There he made himself a shelter, and he sat under it in the shade. So he made a sukkah there, till he might see what would become of the city. So this shelter was to keep out the hot sun there in Iraq. It's hot, maybe 130 degrees Fahrenheit. He could have boiled an egg maybe while he was waiting, but right there on the ground. But anyway, so you see that the sukkah is symbolic of God's protection during this pilgrimage. Now, there's another meaning of the sukkah that has to do with being a church member. As I said, we have a unique responsibility as church members. We don't live as others do, and that sometimes that means, persecution, because we don't do some of the things others do. We have an obligation to authentically live as Christ would have us to live. But if you look in the book of Job, in Job 27, We need to be alert. We need to be spiritually alert if we're going to be Christian. It does take alertness. You know, one thing that I find is that over the years, the same old issues come up. People, when they're young or whenever they come into a knowledge of the truth, they study it out. They make their decisions. They get committed. They develop their convictions. And then after a while, they begin to, you know, get weak or loose or forgetful. And then the same old issues come up again. And the same battles, you know, every so many years, these issues come up. Why don't we do it this way? Or why do we do it that way? And then you have to go, you know, you have to every so often go back. Well, why do we do it this way? Why is it that? And so before you automatically assume that, you know, hey, maybe we should change. First, think about why you did what you did. Even if you do change, but don't just change without thinking about why you did it the way you used to do it. Have that much respect for yourself and for others around you that you must have some reason for what you've been doing until now. Now, yes, maybe you should change, but maybe you shouldn't. Case by case, you know. But think. But we have to be alert, spiritually speaking. And if we let down our guard, then we fail. And the world is depending on us because there's a church that the world is sustained, as you know. The church sustains the world. And so we are like a guard. We are like a watchman. Now, right in this facility where we're staying, there's a guard out there. There's a guard post out there. And they have these vicious wolves but there's a guard out there. And he has a little place where he stays. And that's not his permanent place. He doesn't live there. But it's like a guardhouse. And that's what this temporary dwelling picture is, the kind of a structure that's used by people who are watching, an outpost of people who are watching. And so that's another meaning of this temporary dwelling, that we have to realize that we as church people, we are like watchmen, we are like guards. We have to be on the alert, and we are in effect protecting the existence of this world. It's because God has his church that the world is sustained, because we are the first fruits of God's plan. So if you look in Job 28, in verse 18, he's talking about human life. It says he builds his house like a moth. You know, a moth eventually turns into a caterpillar turns into a butterfly and flies away. You know, so our life is like that. You know, we start out as a kind of caterpillar. You know, the people of Israel are called a worm by God. You know, you worm Jacob, but at the same time, we're eventually going to be the butterfly. We're going to go from physical to spirit, and we'll go from caterpillar to butterfly. But our life is a temporary one. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes, like a sukkah. So he talks here about a temporary dwelling that a watchman makes. So let's take that lesson. You know, when we live in this area, in this temporary situation, let's realize that we are like, in a way, a watchman who has a temporary structure, and he's out there on guard, on the watch. And that's what we should be like that. We should be alert, realizing that we dare not fail because the world depends on us. In 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13, watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. This is what we have to be, like a guard out there. A guard should be, in effect, intimidating. You know, you don't want to have a wimp out there. You know, you want to have a person that really dedicated to his job, really wants to protect. And it's going to be alert. You know, he's not going to be sleeping there when you come up to see him. You know, you have to wake him up. Pardon me, sir, I want to get in. You know, and here he is asleep and so forth. Watch, stand fast in the faith. Be brave, be strong. That's what we have to be. Now, there's yet another point. We want to be alert. We also have to realize that a temporary dwelling was used in ancient times by people who were out harvesting. They would be out in the field, far from their home, harvesting, and they would be working all day and until it gets dark, and then they would just sleep out there in a temporary dwelling, so they could get up in the wee hours and start again to get that harvest in. Don't even bother going home. Just sack out. You know, just rest right there and have a temporary dwelling there to protect yourself during the night. You know, and so it's symbolic of that great harvest. You know, God is eventually going to bring in the masses of humanity to be that great fall harvest, which these holy days picture. Now, I'd like to go to Isaiah 1. Isaiah 1. And in Isaiah 1 and verse 8, it says, so the daughter of Zion is left as a booth in a vineyard, like a sukkah, as a hut in a garden of cucumbers, and as a besieged city. So here, you know, Israel is being condemned, and it says Israel's going under. It's just like a temporary dwelling, like something you build during the harvest, just to give yourself a place to sleep while you're harvesting. So there's a symbolism in the booth, in the temporary dwelling, because, you know, you're going out there to do a job, and the job in this case is harvesting. So it pictures a time when we're going to have a very busy time harvesting in the masses of humanity, when, you know, the church membership will go from whatever minuscule it is now to billions. You know, pictures that time as well. So all of this is symbolic in the Festival of Tabernacles. You know, the fact that God has called us, the fact that we are pilgrims, the fact that he is watching over us during this pilgrimage, the fact that we must be spiritually alert, and the fact that we are going to be participating in a great harvest of souls. All of that is symbolic, is pictured in this day. Now, another important point that is pictured in this day is the fact that there is going to come a time when the world will know and experience the kind of environment that we are enjoying during this festival. This is a time when we are living well, and it's a time when we are feasting, and it's a time when we're together with brethren. And so it does picture a time when the world will come into that kind of relationship with God, the millennium, a time of peace, a time of prosperity. And if you look at Zechariah 14, I won't turn there because I don't know if how am I doing on time. And I'm doing okay on time? All right, then let's go to Zechariah 14. If I have the time, I'll use it. And by the way, while we're in Zechariah 14, let's first go to Hosea. I want to say this about the Exodus. When the millennium begins, the people of Israel will have experienced a second Exodus. God is going to once again have to deliver the descendants of ancient Israel from captivity and oppression. And he's going to have to bring them out of their bondage in a miraculous way. And it'll be so spectacular that it'll even be greater than the first Exodus. And that first Exodus was spectacular. And many a movie has been made, and many a, you know, book has been written, and many a times the story has been told. And, of course, we have the night to be much observed every year where we retell the story of the Exodus. And this is going to be an even greater one. And you can read about it in Jeremiah 3, in Jeremiah 16, and in Jeremiah 23. In all of those verses, you can read about that great Exodus. But I want to read about it in Hosea, the 12th chapter, in the 9th verse. But I am the eternal your God ever since the land of Egypt. I will again make you dwell in tents, as in the days of the appointed feast. So he says, once again, you're going to have to come back from captivity, and you'll be keeping Sukkot as your ancestors did thousands of years ago in the wilderness. You know, there's going to be, so Israel will have that experience as they enter into the millennium. They'll be brought back from captivity, and some of them will be traveling along, coming back, and be in temporary situations until they come back to the land, and then they'll be restored to the land. You see that in Ezekiel 36, 35, 36, and so on in through there. So we have a second Exodus. That's something to think in terms of prophetically. But I want to talk about the millennium as it applies to the Festival of Tabernacles. And if you're in Zechariah 14, I want to tell you this. If you were to review Numbers 29 and you see the sacrifices that were offered at this time of the year, you'll find that on the seventh day of the Festival of Tabernacles, they offered seven bulls at the temple as a sacrifice. But the day before, they had offered eight. And the day before that, they had offered nine, and so on. They started with 13. 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. Now, when you add those together, there's 70. They offered 70 bulls during that time. And the Jews thought, well, that's significant. You know, we talk about, poetically, we talk about the 70 nations of the world. We talk about Israel and the 70 nations of the world. So they associated the Festival of Tabernacles with the 70 nations of the world. And in fact, it does picture a time when the whole world will know God's way. And the reason why the sacrifices are reduced from day to day is probably because the need for the atonement of sin will be reduced as the millennium proceeds. There'll be less and less sin as the millennium proceeds, so there'll be less and less need for the sacrifices in that sense. That's very likely. That idea was presented to me, and I do see some validity with that. But in Zechariah 14, which is where I want to focus, here you see that when we speak of the world of the future and people serving God, the festival that's mentioned is the Festival of Tabernacles. In verse 16 of Zechariah 14, "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Eternal of Hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." And it talks about even Egypt may be reluctant at first, but they'll be compelled to keep it as well. So we see that the Festival of Tabernacles will be a way that the nations will identify themselves as serving God, because they'll be keeping the Festival of Tabernacles. Now, if you go to the book of Revelation, you see a tabernacle scene. If you were to go to the Western Wall today, if you were to go to Hakotel HaMa'aravi, the Western Wall, the so-called Wailing Wall, you'd see a scene such as I'm going to describe to you now. What would you see if you went there? You'd see a lot of men and women, of course, separately, and the men would be in prayer shawls, and they'd be holding palm fronds, and they'd be praying holding palm fronds, and you'd see them in their white garments and holding their palm fronds, and that would be the scene you would see today if you were there. And notice in Revelation 7, verse 9, "And after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands." Now, these Jews that you'd see at the Western Wall, what would they be saying? They'd be saying, you know, Hosanna. They'd be saying, "Save us, O Eternal." And they'd be reciting the Hallel Psalms, you know, 113 to 118, and you'll be hearing one of them at the end of the service here. And notice what it says in verse 10. "And crying out with a loud voice, saying, Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." So this is a Festival of Tabernacles scene that John points to, and it symbolizes the conversion of humanity. Now, if you go to Matthew 17, when we look forward to the world tomorrow, as we call it, you heard in the first hymn, when the world tomorrow is called the world today. But if you look at Matthew 17, Christ gave his leading apostles a vision of that world. And in Matthew 17, "Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. They saw him in a special way, as he will look when he returns. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him." So they're seeing the world as it will be. You know, Moses back, Elijah back, Christ shining like the sun. You know, that's the world of the future. But they saw that vision. "Then Jesus answered and said to, then Peter answered and said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, let us make here three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." So you see how tabernacles is tied in with this. You know, the Festival of Tabernacles does picture that time when the saints will be resurrected and Christ will return. "While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them." Once again, the imagery of the cloud overshadowed them. "And suddenly a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear him." So this festival does picture the millennium. So those are 6 points I have given you. But as you might have suspected, there's a seventh. And this Festival of Tabernacles that we are keeping, we're in a temporary dwelling. God himself is going to lower himself in that sense to reach out to us. He's going to share eternity with us. His love, in effect, compels him to do so. There's no outside force that's any greater than he is. He's the greatest force. Nothing compares. But his love, in effect, you could say, compels him to do that, to lower himself to the level of angels and to the level of people, and to share eternity with us, to tabernacle with us. Now, if you want to go to the Hallel, let's do some halleling here. Let's do some praising. Psalm 113. Psalm 113, verse 4. The Eternal is high above all nations, His glory above the heavens. Who is like the Eternal our God who dwells on high, who humbles Himself to behold the things that are in the heavens and in the earth? He humbles Himself to deal with angels and then even more so to deal with us. And so this He tabernacles with us. Let's go to Isaiah 57, if you don't mind jumping over there. Isaiah 57, and we want to go to verse 15. For thus says the High and Lofty One, who inhabits eternity, Shochenad, He inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with Him who has a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. So this God who is so great nevertheless dwells with people who are humble. That's the paradox or the irony. He doesn't dwell with the arrogant. The arrogant, are despised. He dwells with the humble. He humbles Himself in that sense. And He has humbled Himself to share His glory with us, to tabernacle with us. And this festival pictures that. Just as we are in this facility, He travels, in effect, to be with us. Now, there are four great tabernaclings of God that I see in the Bible. Four great tabernaclings of God with human beings. The first one I've already talked about is the time of the Exodus, when He was with us, with our ancestors in the wilderness, when He was very much around, the fire, the cloud, the manna, the water from the rock, when He was very much there. There's another tabernacling. And that is the ministry of Jesus Christ, when God became man, when He took on a body. The body was His sukkah. John 1 and verse 14. And if you have a good marginal note in your Bible, you'll see this. John 1, 14. And the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. And we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. So here God tabernacles with people in the person of Jesus Christ. He became flesh and the Word of God tabernacled among us. Those are two tabernaclings of God. But there's going to come a third tabernacling of God with human beings, and that is when Christ returns. And as I already showed you, in Matthew 17, when they saw the vision of Christ returning with Moses and Elijah, they wanted to build tabernacles because God will once again be tabernacling with us in a direct sense. We will have His presence here in a way that is, tangible, and Christ will be here and the saints resurrected. And beyond that, there's a fourth tabernacling far ahead, beyond the millennium, when our relationship to God is more intimate than it will have ever been before. When Christ surrenders up His power to God the Father, as it says in 1 Corinthians 15, I believe verse 24. And what I want to go to, though, is in the book of Revelation. So if you'll go to Revelation with me, that's another example of the tabernacling, which I wanted to get to. Revelation 21. Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem. I referred to that earlier, that city that we can look forward to, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And this is a family time. This is a time for husbands and wives to have part of the festival should be a kind of second honeymoon for husbands and wives. Please keep that in mind, you spouses out there. And also parents and children also. Keep in mind parents and children to spend time together at this time. Revelation 21:3. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. And He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. So here, this final tabernacling, where God the Father is united with men, and this is on the spirit level. So this now, this family relationship, of course, continues, you know, for all eternity, as I read last night, verse 7, he who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. So this final tabernacling of God with men is on God's part a tabernacling, because he is in effect lowering himself to interact with us, but it lifts us up, you know, and we are able to then interact with him, and that never ends. It just gets better and better and better and better and better forever. That's what we can look forward to. And all of those points are tied in with the keeping of this festival. So I gave you seven points that I believe summarize the significance of this Festival of Tabernacles. It is a very powerful message for us, very inspiring to us, I hope motivating to us to want to remain with this way of life, and to recommit ourselves to it, revive our enthusiasm for it. To all of those who hear this message, then Chag Sameach, happy festival. Have a wonderful Festival of Tabernacles, and all the best to you and yours. But please stay with us for this hymn that is we are introducing. You know, it says in the Bible, sing to the Eternal a new song, Shir Chadash. And so that's what we are doing. We did it last night, and we're doing it now. It is a new song, but, of course, biblically grounded. It goes to Psalm 119. It's called He Saved Me. It's adapted from Psalm, 116. Did I say 119? 116. 116. He Saved Me is the title. And even though you don't know it because it's new, but you can maybe turn to Psalm 116 anyway and listen to Daniel and the rest of us as we do this. I'm going to ask Daniel to play it once through, just so that all of you can hear the melody out there wherever you're listening, and then we'll all sing it together. thanks again to Daniel. Thanks for all of you who have been listening. We do plan to webcast all through the week. I realize for some of you it will be very early because we'll be having services in the morning at 10 o'clock here. But on Friday, we'll be having an evening Bible study at 8 o'clock Eastern time. That might be more convenient if you want to hear it live. Of course, you can be downloading these messages and hearing them whenever you want to hear them. And then on Sunday, we'll be back again at 10 a.m. and then Monday. But then on Tuesday, the final service, we probably will go ahead. What do you think? And maybe we should do it at 3 since we see there are listeners out there. So by the consensus of the group here, all right, we'll go ahead on the last day, the 8th day of Sacred Assembly, and we'll have on that holy day a 3 p.m. service Eastern time, so some of you perhaps can be listening live. So again, a happy festival to all of you.